What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico is more than just a tropical paradise. It's an innovations paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, Puerto Rico has the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, this is the place to bring it. Find out more at investpr.org/economist.
The Economist.
Hello, and welcome to The Intelligence from The Economist. I'm your host, Ora Ogunbiyi. Every weekday, we provide a fresh perspective on the events shaping your world. India's first test of a new missile is not just news for the nuclear nerds. It's evidence of a new geopolitics in which India is getting worried about China's power, and nuclear weapons are much more prominent. And fertility rates are actually falling across the world, but in sub-Saharan Africa, not fast enough. What will it take to close the gap? First up, though. In the rich world, there are at least 250 million people born between 1997 and 2012, including myself. Well, just. There's a lot of fluff out there about Gen Z. They say we're all lazy and we don't want to work anymore. They say we're too woke. Well, what's wrong with that? They say we spend all our time on screens and we don't read books, blah, blah, blah. Yet different generations also display deeper differences in their personalities, in part because of the economic context in which they grew up. Millennials came of working age during a global financial crisis, whilst baby boomers benefited from the, well, boom caused by the golden age of capitalism. Many argue that Gen Z is defined by its anxiety. We're more likely to be depressed or say that we were assigned the wrong sex at birth. Also less likely to drink, to have sex, or be in a relationship. But when it comes to young people's finances, this generation might actually be the GOAT. That's young people speak for greatest of all time.
In financial terms, Gen Z is actually doing pretty well.
Callum Williams is a senior economics writer for The Economist.
And it turns out that Zoomers are actually the richest generation in history. And this in turn is changing their relationship with work.
But Callum, that doesn't sound right. I mean, there's stories all the time about how Gen Z is struggling. So what's going on here?
Well, I think in many ways, Gen Z is struggling. They've obviously gone through a lot in the past few years. Firstly, they had to deal with the pandemic, which disrupted schooling, disrupted universities. And then after that, we've just had kind of constant global unrest. But what I'm focusing on really is the financial side, and there things are actually going quite well. Youth unemployment, so unemployment for people in their like late teens and early 20s, is the lowest it's been in many decades. We'll all be familiar with the narrative that you see a lot in the press about the labour shortage and about how employers find it difficult to find workers. Now, that's actually relatively good news for people in Gen Z. Certainly, if you compare them to what the millennials went through in the early 2010s and even the mid-2010s, youth unemployment was very, very high. And so it was quite difficult for a lot of those workers to find a job. And even for people who did find jobs, it was often difficult to find jobs that like really suited their skill set and suited their preferences. So in that sense, millennials are doing very well. And also what it means is that they have more choice over where they want to work. And what that means in turn is they can demand higher wages. They can demand different, better conditions. And so if you look at wages, for example, in the US recently, the pay growth of Gen Zers hit about 12 to 13% year on year. So each year, people in that age bracket are seeing their average wages grow by 12 to 13%. Now, that is very, very high by historical standards. And it's also very, very high in comparison with other age groups. And what you can see is that these trends are not just confined to America. They're broadly something that you see across the rich world as a whole.
On the topic of jobs and wages, just how rich are these Gen Z peeps?
the average income of a 25-year-old in the US is about $40,000, which is very high. It's a lot higher than millennials' incomes at the same age when millennials are 25. In fact, it's a lot higher than any generation at age 25. It's about 50% higher than what the boomers were earning in real terms, i.e. adjusted for inflation. We do have some other data from other countries. It's less detailed, but it sort of basically shows that if you look at the incomes of young people in comparison to older people, that gap has been closing in recent years.
Sorry, Callum, I'm not having that as a Gen Z babe. Have you seen how much we're paying for housing or for university? I don't think we're really financially that much better off than the generation before us.
Well, you're right to point to the housing market. House prices are like pretty much near an all-time high. And obviously the cost of university is going up every year. So those are two big challenges. I guess what I would say is if you look at the data on home ownership, Gen Zers are actually doing pretty well, certainly compared with the millennials. They are getting on the housing ladder earlier than the millennials were, which is kind of unsurprising given that they're earning better than the millennials did at the same age. So that's the one thing I would say. On education, yes, things are expensive. But again, how this all kind of washes out is, again, if you look at the US, the amount that Gen Zers are devoting towards housing and education and student loan repayments is actually slightly below the long run average. And so to be very clear about this, this is not because housing is not expensive, which it is. It's not because education is not expensive, which it is. It's because Gen Zers are actually earning pretty well.
So how has all this success that Gen Z apparently has influenced their attitude to work?
Well, I think it's really to do with bargaining power. You know, this is like a basic idea in labor relations. When labor markets are tight, when there is strong demand for labor, when there's a labor shortage, workers have more bargaining power in the workplace. And what this basically means is that they can demand things of their employer, and their employer it has to a degree, accommodate those requests. So some of the stereotypes about Gen Z, it turns out, are kind of true. Gen Zers do want to work less than previous generations did. In fact, they do actually work less than each week than previous generations did. There's also this kind of general sense, which I think is true, that work is less central to Gen Zers' life than it was for the millennials in previous generations. They're less likely to define themselves by their work than people who are now in their 30s and 40s. And I think really the root of all this is because work, finding a job and doing well at work is just a little bit easier for the Gen Zers than it was for the millennials. And so in a way, they can afford to take their foot off the accelerator just a little bit.
Callum, I feel like you're on a mission to slyly tell my employers that I want to work less. That's not true. But if it were true, what kind of impact would that have?
It can have benefits for employers. The problem with millennials is, in many cases, is they've grown up with the idea that having a job is a privilege. They can be kind of too deferent. They can be too kind of risk averse. They can, you know, not stand up for themselves. And that can actually cause companies problems. You've now got a situation where Gen Zers are coming into the labor market, and to a degree, they're not willing to put up with the bad stuff that millennials were happy to put up with. And so I think it's very easy to say that Gen Zers are lazy, their boundaries are too big, they don't do what they're told. But I think there is definitely an upside too, because having employers who want to have a say and want to have a voice in the workplace, I think is on the whole a good thing.
Callum, do you think that Gen Z's economic advantage is going to last?
I think it's important to remember one thing in particular, which is that when there is a recession, which there will be at some point, the young always suffer the most. They're last in and they're first out. If that recession comes this year or next year or the year after, the Gen Zers are going to suffer. And so all of the things we've been talking about could change. That's, I think, the biggest risk. The other risk, which is kind of unknowable at the moment, is to do with AI. People are, of course, worried that AI is going to eliminate a lot of entry-level jobs. Those are the kinds of jobs that the Gen Zers would take. At the moment, that's more of a theoretical concern than a practical one, though.
Callum, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
There's more on the challenges for Gen Z in this week's edition of Babbage, our science and technology podcast. We investigate whether smartphones and social media are harming teenagers and ask how young people can form healthier relationships with technology. You don't have to be a subscriber to download this particular edition. So find Babbage wherever you get your podcasts.
What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico is more than just a tropical paradise. It's an innovations paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, Puerto Rico has the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, this is the place to bring it. Find out more at investpr.org/economist.
As it stands today, there are now 9 countries that have an atomic bomb. The United States, Russia, the United Kingdom, France, China, Israel, Pakistan, North Korea, and India. We spoke recently on this show about how America is navigating this new reality. But they're not the only ones reassessing and reasserting their nuclear stance.
India is working right now to soup up its nuclear capabilities quite significantly.
Shashank Joshi is The Economist's defense editor.
In March, it held the 10th launch of the Agni 5. That's India's first ever intercontinental ballistic missile, or ICBM, which is capable of striking any part of China. But the significance of that 10th test lay inside the nose cone. It was the first test of something that nuclear wonks call a MIRV.
Shashank, what's a MIRV?
I'm glad you asked. A MIRV is a multiple independently targetable reentry vehicle. So let's break that down. Imagine a missile with a nose cone on top, and inside that nose cone, you might have one big nuclear warhead, which is the kind of standard idea people have. Now, imagine if instead of one big one, you had lots of smaller ones, each of them capable of independently striking a different target, including targets that are hundreds of kilometers away from one another. So that technology was first developed by America in the 1960s. India's going to have to conduct a lot more tests before it has confidence in its own MIRV capability. But this is a pretty significant technological triumph for Indian scientists. It marks a pretty big development in India's nuclear posture, and they've achieved it more quickly than we thought they would just a few years ago.
Can you break that down for us a little bit more? I mean, how would the use of MIRVs change an attack from India should one ever be needed?
They have effectively 3 advantages. Number one is that they give India greater assurance that a nuclear warhead would get through any future Chinese missile defense system. And that's obviously because it's harder to stop a missile that's releasing lots of different warheads, including perhaps decoys, rather than just one. The second advantage is that if China, or indeed perhaps Pakistan, were to destroy a portion of India's nuclear missiles on the ground, a smaller number of the surviving missiles would still carry enough firepower to inflict existential damage in return, because they would have so many more warheads inside each one. And the third advantage is that MIRVs allow India to substitute accuracy for firepower. And that's because independently targetable warheads are thought to be more accurate. The reason this matters for India is because in 1998, when it tested its nuclear weapons, it's thought to have failed to successfully test a thermonuclear bomb. You don't have to be accurate if you have a thermonuclear bomb on top of your missile. What MIRVs allow is India to use a larger number of less powerful fission bombs to deliver essentially the same effect as one big H-bomb. And then, I guess, in addition to all of those things, there's one other thing worth mentioning, which is that long-range missiles, they tend to cost a lot more than warheads. So if you could get an equivalent number of warheads by having lots more of them on one missile than having to have a lot of missiles, then you're going to save money. And for India, that's really important because they spend a lot less than China.
Shashank, what's prompted this?
I think what India is worried about is the rapid pace of the growth in the size and sophistication of China's nuclear and military forces. First of all, China's ability to destroy Indian nuclear weapons on the ground is growing, and so India has to have a more survivable nuclear force. And I think the other concern is that Chinese ballistic missile defenses could become a lot better, and that could, again, stop Indian missiles from getting through and that could undercut India's nuclear deterrence in a crisis. In fact, we've just seen how Israel has stopped a huge barrage of something like 120 Iranian ballistic missiles. Now, stopping ICBMs is a lot more difficult than that. But nonetheless, India doesn't know what's going to be technologically possible in 10 years or 20 years. And so I think it's hedging against those kind of possibilities.
And are there any downsides to this?
There are downsides. So when America and the Soviet Union began merging their missiles in the 1970s, that technology contributed to a breakneck arms race. The reason for that is because of the nature of MIRVs. They make it easier for one country to launch a disarming first strike against an enemy nuclear force because they are so much more accurate and you can deliver so much more firepower per strike. And then on the other side of the equation, you're also making these things attractive targets for an enemy first strike because suddenly by striking one of your missiles, it doesn't just take out one warhead, it takes out three or five or 10. And those dynamics can encourage countries to build bigger arsenals. And here I think is a little bit more worrying aspect of this, to launch them more quickly in a crisis. So there is a potentially destabilizing aspect to MIRVs. And I think that the lessons of the Cold War show the effect they can have on arms racing.
Now, we've discussed India and China, but does this change the nuclear landscape elsewhere?
I think what we're seeing is a world in which nuclear weapons are not just becoming more prominent, but countries are thinking more specifically in detail, in a technological sense, about detailed nuclear calculations as part of deterrence. So China deployed MIRVs on some missiles a while ago. Pakistan tested them in 2017. Some years ago, America had a lot of MIRVs, and then it de-MIRVed its missiles. It took them away. That was designed to make things more stable. Now, with more concerns around China's nuclear arsenal, the growing prominence of Russia's nuclear forces, and the problem of deterring both Russia and China at once, as I discussed on this show not long ago, Americans are saying we should move back towards MIRVs. I think that probably is potentially more destabilizing, even if it also contributes to deterrence in some way. But I think the other story here is that the arsenals of countries like India, Pakistan, China, North Korea, these were just not very sophisticated 20 or 30 years ago. And we are seeing this incredible technological growth. Pakistan has tactical nuclear weapons. China is putting nuclear weapons at sea. India is racing ahead with MIRV technology. This really is a new and much, much more diverse nuclear age than anything we've seen in the past.
Shashank, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
In recent decades, sub-Saharan Africa has been experiencing a baby boom, a result of rapidly improving healthcare that's now putting pressure on the continent's public services. Yet globally, fertility rates are tumbling because of better education for women and access to contraceptives, including in China and India, which account for more than a third of the world's population. In sub-Saharan Africa, though, that decline is happening much more slowly than elsewhere.
By the end of the century, just over half of the world's children will be born in sub-Saharan Africa, according to a Lancet study.
Anne Hanna is a news editor at The Economist.
More babies are born in the region than any other, and people are also living longer, so the region's population will double by 2050, and that will stretch already underfunded resources.
And what exactly did this study by The Lancet find?
So the study looked at total fertility rates, and that's the average number of children that women will have in their lifetime. And it looked at each region between 1950 and 2021. And they found that global total fertility rates had fallen by more than half from almost 5 in 1950 to just over 2 in 2021. But in Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, that rate has fallen more slowly, and it remains close to 4.29. The study forecasts total fertility rates until 2100, and it also takes into account things like female education, population density, and the rates of contraceptive use. And the gap between sub-Saharan Africa and the rest of the world is going to close by the end of the century.
Okay, you say the gap will close, but you also said that half the world's children will be born in sub-Saharan Africa.
Yes, so by 2075, sub-Saharan Africa's total fertility rate is expected to be at about 2.1, which is the rate at which a population remains stable. And in 2100, it's going to be about 1.82, which is close to where Denmark and Ireland are now, driven by more education and more job prospects for women in the region. But that doesn't necessarily mean that there won't be more children there than anywhere else. In 2100, the global total fertility rate is going to drop to about 1.5.
Okay, so the gap will close a little bit, but there still seems to be a divergence. Could that trend change?
Yeah, so there are reasons to think that the convergence could happen faster, and there are reasons to suggest that it's already happening a little bit faster than the UN has previously projected. And that's largely to do with the improved education that we're seeing for girls and the increase in contraceptive use by women. And governments can offer better family planning and invest more in education, and then that drop will happen much more quickly. And we can already see examples of that. So, for example, in Angola, women without schooling have 7.8 children on average, but women with tertiary education have about 2.3. And the Lancet study predicts that if universal female education or contraceptive needs are met by 2030, the total fertility rate would fall to about 2.3 in 2050 instead of their previously predicted 2.7. That's probably an unlikely thing, but it is something that should motivate governments to try.
Anne, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
That's all for this episode of The Intelligence. As always, you can let us know what you think of the show by reaching out at podcast@economist.com. And we'll see you back here tomorrow.
What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico is more than just a tropical paradise. It's an innovations paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, Puerto Rico has the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, this is the place to bring it. Find out more at investpr.org/economist.